Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Atlanta Legal Experts Radio. I am your host, Emily Rowell, with Peachtree Offices, and I have Rich Casanova
here
with me again.
Well, you feel like I'm in class when you say my name, whatever, yeah. So you got a great show this morning.
I know, we're packed full today.
Yeah, you're a returning guest as a co-host, and I'm a little bit off the clock. I can just be the producer engineer this morning.
You can always tune in.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I'll chime in. Chime in. Hi, and then we also have Alex Brown this
morning.
He is my co-host today. He's trying out for a full-time position.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah. He's going to leave that legal profession thing, whatever. Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about today's show. We've got some very special guests. And we, as I said, Alex Brown here. We have also Dahlia Racine. She is the DeKalb County, I'm sorry, she's the Assistant District Attorney with DeKalb County District Attorney's Office.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
And Julia Latimer with Ashenden and Associates.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Eric Coleman with Winter, Capriola, and Zenner.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm going to, you know, ask a couple questions and talk about Alex real quick just to introduce him for the show. He actually practices in the area of commercial and residential real estate transactions and litigation. He received his law degree in 2009 in the top 3% of his class at John Marshall Law School. And before joining Bagwell & Associates, he worked as an assistant district attorney in the Complex Case Division in Fulton County. He appears regularly on HLN and CNN as a national legal correspondent and has provided legal commentary on nationally televised news media for radio, Atlanta Legal Experts, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're glad to have you today.
I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, this is fun. So I have a couple questions. What's going on in your life currently? Do you have any tips or pointers or feeling out whether or not to work with a real estate agent if you don't already have one? There's a lot of people that try to do their, home buyers or whatever. Well, what is that?
Yeah, don't do for sale by owner, please.
For sale by owner. Thank you. I couldn't get it. It's too early.
It never works out well. You think that it's going to and that it's going to be really easy, but it's not. Realtors really do a lot more behind the scenes, just like closing attorneys do, than you see at the table when you're closing. And so it's really important to have a professional working on that transaction. You know, it's kind of like plastic surgery. There are things that you don't skimp on. There are things that it's okay to pay full price for. And that's really one of them when you're talking about buying your house. So,
okay. And who comes to mind when you think about real estate agents?
It's really more qualities than I think individual people, though there are some that I would work with myself in town. Really, I think when you're looking for a real estate agent as a buyer, you need to find somebody that's going to do more for you than you could really do for yourself, say, you know, on Zillow or Trulia or something that you could look up online. Mm-hmm. I know a couple of people in town. The first one that comes to mind is Eric Simeone. He's with Palmer House Properties. And just one of those people that can go into a house and not just tell you the square footage and when it was built, but really just about everything about the neighborhood, you know, who's lived there in the past, the materials that the house is built with, houses and condos. He is really, you know, a wealth of knowledge for the Midtown and North Atlanta area. Mm-hmm. The other thing you want to look for is if you're not buying for a residential purpose, like you're buying as an investor or you're buying to flip, it's really important to get a realtor that is familiar with those types of properties, because they are really different. You're looking for different things than you would be if you're looking for just your house. So another really great one is Lorraine Beato. I have never seen a person who knows more people than her. She knows everybody. and that is just a huge benefit to her clients. She can really go into a place and size it up in like 10 minutes and tell you if it's a, you know, if it's worth your while as an investor or whether it's just sort of pretty and, you know, looks like it's going to be an easy flip. So it's really important to get someone to add that value with their service.
So question for you, we've said here on the show several times, if you, you know, looking for an attorney or looking for a doctor, you know, you always want to have at least three that you talk to first and see who you're most comfortable with. Is that the same with the real estate agent?
I think comfort is really a big deal when you're talking about real estate agents. That they communicate in the way that you communicate. If you're a texter and they don't know how to send a text message, that's clearly going to be a problem. You know, if you do everything by email and they're never by the computer, going to be a problem. So you need to find somebody that you're comfortable with that communicates the way you do. And that seems to really want your business. I mean, there are a lot of realtors in Atlanta, and so you want to make sure that you get one that is interested in working for you.
Well, speaking of real estate, you're actually expanding with your office. You're going to in the future have a couple of locations, I was told.
I am.
Tell me about that.
And thank you for that. Actually, we're going to be working with you and your company on that, at least at first moving into Midtown to just sort of scout out some space. And then I'm excited to work with you because the space that you offer at least is sizable, so I can come in small and then get bigger and not have to move all around.
Yeah.
So thank you. We really appreciate that.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Now, what business opportunities will come from that, having more locations?
Well, we have people we're in Sandy Springs now, and we have Midtown agents tell us all the time, oh, we would love to close with you if you had a Midtown office. And so we are going to take them up on that. we're going to have one and see if that's smoke or if they're serious about it. So that's coming here in the new year.
Well, it's great. The advantage you have is that you can try it out.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You don't have to commit to a very long term. And that's what we do. We help attorneys build their business. So that's awesome. And let's go ahead and introduce Ms. Dahlia Racine. I'm going to go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning.
Again. And thanks again for being here. And I'm going to read her bio quickly. And I'll read just a portion. And you can go to AtlantaLegalExperts.com to see the entire bio. She is running for district attorney because she believes that Douglas deserves better. She dedicated her entire legal career to prosecution. She handled homicide, rape, child abuse, human trafficking, animal abuse, robbery, and many other types of cases during her tenure. Throughout her career, she learned that what it takes to have an effective and efficient district attorney's office. That's why she believes Douglas deserves better. She has a better approach to crime prevention. She will serve with better integrity and better staffing. And so she is actually going to tell us a lot more about that today. And I will go ahead and ask the first question. And it's a hot topic, but it's awful. Tell me a little bit about the human trafficking issue in Atlanta.
Well, we unfortunately have the distinction of being world-ranked for the problem of human trafficking. And for those that are unaware of what that looks like, you know, a lot of times we hear human trafficking and we think of the movie Taken and things like that. But the reality is that our biggest issue here in the Atlanta area is domestic supply. So it's our own children that are being brought into the sex trade. Mm. The average age of entry for girls is 12 to 14. The average age of entry for boys is 11 to 13. So this is an issue that is affecting us deeply. The statistics show that within 72 hours, one in four runaways will be approached by an exploiter. And, you know, everything's going to the internet, right? You know, everyone's on social media, all that kind of stuff. But where the dangers lie is that your child could be recruited under your roof via social media, via all the different apps and different vehicles that are out there now to communicate so quickly. And so this is a huge issue that we're having here in the Atlanta area.
I heard it was becoming an epidemic.
Absolutely. I think to say it's becoming is a bit of a misnomer. I think that our awareness is increasing. I think it's always been there, and now we're realizing, whoa, this is going on with our kids. We need to do something about this. Mm-hmm.
And it's not like it's just in the bad parts of the city. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere because everywhere, I mean, name one jurisdiction that doesn't have runaways. And that's really the leading indicator. And 80 to 90% of the children brought into the sex trade have been sexually abused already at home. So if the grooming, if you will, has already been done at home. And so it's a very easy transition for these children to then be pushed into the sex trade.
Mm. Hmm. So tell me, are there current laws legalizing prostitution in the state of Georgia?
So sometimes we hear that as a counter to our efforts to protect the children that are brought into this horrific area. And so a lot of times we'll hear individuals say, hey, but by loosening the restrictions, if you will, on these children, because in the state of Georgia, it's still potentially a crime for a child to be arrested for prostitution. which is kind of counterintuitive to what the reality of human trafficking is. These children don't really have a choice. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of coercion, a lot of deception that's involved to bring them in. And so I've testified before different committee hearings as to these laws. And in Georgia, we are very lucky to have some very strong laws when it comes to human trafficking. But there has been some pushback saying that we're trying to legalize it. And I think that's just a misunderstanding of the reality of the situation.
Mm. So what is it like, we'll talk about you a little bit, running for office as a woman, a mother, a wife, and a prosecutor?
Yeah.
I have a lot of titles, too. I wear a lot of hats myself. You're
right. I'm tired just hearing you ask the question.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that this extends beyond just running for office. And no offense to the men in the room, but I think, too, especially for women who are in a professional setting, and if you choose to have a family, you do have to wear a lot of hats, and you do get pulled in a lot of directions, and you're constantly challenging yourself to say, am I being adequate in all the areas that I've committed myself to?
Yep. Relating.
Right. And no less so when you're running for office. You know, it's a position where you're really trying to make an impact countywide to a larger group of people, to protect a large group of people and serve a large group of people. And you just want to make sure that you're doing everything to the best of your abilities. Mm-hmm. So it can be challenging. It's a sacrifice when you run for office. Everybody sacrifices, not just the candidate, but the family members, the children. My kids are, I have 7-year-old twins and a 9-year-old. And sometimes they don't fully understand what I'm doing. I mean, sure. If you ask them, what's mommy do? They say she puts the bad guys away.
I love that.
But they don't really understand. They know that I'm running for office. But there are days where they say, you know, mommy, can you please just stay home? And they may not understand that part, but I know that it's for the greater good. It's ultimately for their benefit as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially in the longer run. So tell me, why are you running for office in Douglas County? And I'll let Alex take over after this question.
I was scared for Alex to ask me a question, so I'm glad.
I don't know if you've been asked that yet.
At all.
I haven't at all. This is my first time. No. So the decision for me to run was not one that was made lightly. Like you read earlier, I am a career prosecutor. Alex and I actually had some time that we worked together over in Fulton County. So having the opportunity to try the tough cases, to see what it takes, to know what works, to know what doesn't work when it comes to an effective prosecutor's office. I've lived in Douglas County for close to a decade and just got tired of hearing what was going on in my own backyard. And I chose to raise my family in Douglas County. And just knowing that we deserve better and knowing that I was the one that could do that. I would never have put myself in this position if I didn't think that I could get the job done. And so that's why I've stepped up. Like you said, I just believe that on a lot of fronts that we can do better. And I believe with my breadth of experience that I can make that happen.
I'm excited. Go ahead, Alex. I actually wanted to continue interviewing her because I'm so into it. I completely forgot about you. I apologize.
Hi.
I got to do better at the host. Go ahead.
Thank you for remembering me. I appreciate it. So, Dahlia, we tried several cases together in Fulton County, but I don't think we ever tried a Crimes Against Women and Children case together. What do you find unique about those cases?
Yeah, I think, Alex, you and I stuck to homicides together.
We did. Who would have thought that we'd go from the back of T.I.'s limo to here on a radio show?
I think we need to clarify why we were in the back of T.I.'s
limo. Well, we were interviewing. It was for a case. We were interviewing people for a case, but... That clearly was a different kind of case. And so what do you find unique about crimes against women and children?
You know, I think those are some of the toughest cases to prosecute, but I think at the same time, the most important cases. When statistically it shows that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be abused in childhood, you know that the numbers are overwhelming. You know that there's a lot of children that are victimized. The issue with prosecuting those types of cases is it's usually testimonial. And in the world of prosecution and in most litigation, you know, physical evidence and hard evidence is usually what you look for in determining how successful you could be in a case. And when it comes to child abuse cases, a lot of times the body heals within 72 hours. We're not finding any physical evidence. A lot of bruising is gone. Things along those lines, even with the physical abuse scenarios, because so many of these cases are delayed disclosures, that we have to work on just what the child says a lot of times. And so if you like to investigate, if you like I don't know if I would say the CSI, because we hate that in the world of prosecution,
yes,
the CSI epidemic. But if you like that challenge, these are the types of cases that you can latch on to, because you're corroborating everything that the child has said to try and make it so that when you put them on the stand and you put that case up, it's not them standing by themselves.
Mm. And so this has been an issue in the past that sort of people try to keep it quiet. But lately, with all of the attention that the NFL has brought to it, it's an issue people are talking about. How is that? What are your opinions on that? And how has that worked into your campaign, since this is sort of a platform for you?
Mm-hmm. Specifically as to the child abuse, or you mean more so the domestic violence, or?
Really both. I mean, it's really become a talking point on both regards.
Absolutely. You know, I think that awareness always helps. We always notice that when big stories break, our disclosures increase. But the reality is that no matter what that increase is, we know that this is one of the most underreported crimes. And back to the human trafficking issue with a lot of the misunderstanding, we always compare it to say human trafficking is now where domestic violence was 20 years ago. But what I thought was very interesting, especially with the Ray Rice case that came up, the commentary on social media, right? You saw a lot of blaming of the victim in the case. You saw a lot of, well, if she didn't want to be there, she wouldn't have stayed, or if there was not some understanding, or it's their business, all these types of things. And you kind of see these misunderstandings resurface. And those are throughout all these types of cases. You know, child abuse, you always hear, well, why didn't they just scream out? Or why didn't they say something when it was happening? And the same with domestic violence. Why do they stay? And it's so complex. And I think it's so important that, especially as a prosecutor and as a DA, that you have people staffed in your office that get this, because you have to make it clear to the jury why these victims do what they do.
So, Dahlia, when are we going out to vote for you?
Well, thank you, Alex, for asking that. First, you have to move to Douglas County. And then October 6th is the last day to register to vote. And that's statewide. So October 6th, you have to be registered to vote. That's the last day. Early voting starts October 13th. And then it goes for 3 weeks. And then the final day to vote is November 4th.
And in the meantime, Dahlia, how do we get in touch with you? What's the best way to learn about you?
Yeah, I think the best way is going to be the website, which is www.racine2014.com.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Alex. I've missed you so much.
I've missed you too. I can't wait to come see you in Douglas.
Likewise.
So our next guest is Julia Latimer. Julia attended Mercer University as a TIFF scholar, where she graduated and also obtained her Bachelor of Arts degree in journalism and Spanish. She received her Juris Doctor from Florida Coastal University of Law, where she received the Dean's Pro Bono Graduation Certificate for her volunteer work while she was there. She also received the Dean's Certificate of Achievement while attending the University of Miami School of Law as a visiting student. During law school, she studied internationally at the Universidad de Sevilla in Sevilla, Spain. She has a working knowledge of the Spanish language, and after law school, she worked for Katz, Stepp, Wright, and Fleming in Atlanta before joining Ashendene and Associates as an associate lawyer. She handles primarily personal injury cases, auto accident, wrongful death, slip and fall, and workers' comp cases. Julia volunteers with the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation Saturday Lawyers Program, where she works with children, and she's also a member of the DeKalb County Lawyers Association. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So you do personal injury cases and traffic accident cases, right?
That's correct. And also wrongful death and workers' compensation, anything involving an injured plaintiff or claimant.
Okay, so you must also deal with insurance companies?
I deal with insurance companies a lot.
So when you're buying auto insurance, I think most people just think that they need to have it but don't know much more. What kind of coverage and limits do you recommend?
Well, purchasing insurance has changed drastically in the last 10 years, actually the last 20 years, because we've become so technologically advanced. It used to be that you'd go into a location, and you'd know your agent by first name. They knew you by first name, and they'd go over all of the coverages with you and explain to you exactly what you're getting. But these days, we get online, we get on our phone, and we type in quote, and we pick the cheapest one, and they send us the documents. We e-sign. Sometimes we don't read everything that they send us. And, you know, we get our cards, and it comes to us by email. But so often we have clients that come to us and they tell us they've been in an accident and they don't know what kind of insurance the other driver has, but they also don't know what kind of coverage they have. And we actually have to call and figure out what kind of limits they have. So at Ashenden & Associates, where we, our founding partner, Tom Ashenden, has been representing injured people for 30 years, we recommend certain limits for our clients because we know it's not something that you want to think about at the last minute. You want to have that already in place to protect you and your household and your automobile. For uninsured motorist coverage, which is very important in Georgia because there's 10%, the statistics say, who don't have insurance. There are people driving around on Georgia roads who don't have insurance. So that's 1 in 10. And a lot of times these people who are not with insurance, it's because they can't afford the premiums because they have too many points on their license. So you have bad drivers who are on the roads and they're going to be predisposed to having accidents. So if you're hit by someone who does not have insurance, yes, they get a citation from the police officer and they may get their license suspended, but what happens to you, the person who's been injured? So we recommend having at least 100,000 to 300,000 in uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage on your vehicle, and we prefer that that be add-on insurance so that it stacks on top of what the other person has. Even if you have a person who hits you who does have insurance, the state minimum in Georgia is $25,000 for liability. So oftentimes that is not enough to cover your medical bills, your lost wages. Just a trip to the hospital can be $1,000 in an ambulance. And if you have an overnight stay and they do a lot of diagnostic testing, it can be easily a $10,000 ER visit. If you're out of work 2 weeks, depending on how much you make, that could be another $5,000, $10,000. So now you've already exceeded that state minimum of $25,000. So we do recommend $100,000 to $300,000 in uninsured motorists just to protect you and everyone in your household.
I would have never thought to look for that. Thank you. So say that you do get in an accident. What do you do? I mean, what do you do from an insurance standpoint to help your case?
That is a great question because I think magically plaintiff's attorneys wish they could pop up in the potential client's head and tell them immediately what things they need to do. And there are five things that I think you need to know up front as soon as it happens, because understandably, when you're injured, especially when you're very seriously injured, you're not thinking about my case and insurance. Right. You're thinking about how am I going to get better? How do I gather myself? But the number one thing is notice. You want to tell the proper parties about your injury. Because unfortunately, if you leave and you go get your medical help, when you come back to try and go after whoever's responsible, whose negligence has caused your injuries, if there's no notice, then you sometimes have a problem and it's harder to prove your case. So in an automobile accident, that's pretty easy to do. It's a police report. You need to have that third party there who can basically extinguish the he said, she said, because if there's no police report, then it's your word against the other person's word. If you get injured on someone's property or in a company, then the proper party to notify is a supervisor or an employee. The number two thing after notice is to take pictures. I know, Dahlia, you were mentioning that these bruises go away and the injuries that show the impact sometimes just aren't, they heal, which is a good thing. But when it comes to proving the case, if you don't have documentation of what happened, then it can cause problems. So it's a good idea to not only take pictures of the scene, taking pictures of the property damage, but to also take pictures of your visible injuries. If you have scrapes, bruises, cuts, bleeding, you want to take pictures of them now so that you can later show exactly what the impact was. Number three would be to report all of your injuries. Make sure you're telling the person, the police officer or the supervisor, exactly what is hurting. I think sometimes clients, they will think that injuries and ambulance is synonymous, and that if they don't need an ambulance, then they're not injured. But if your back is hurting and you know you're going to go home and try to self-medicate and take care of yourself, then you want to be sure to at least say it. At least tell the police officer, this is what's hurting, because a lot of times you're running on adrenaline and you don't know the extent of your injuries until the next day. So as long as you've documented it, that's going to help you in the long run as far as your case is concerned. Number four would be to get all witness information. The people who come up to you after you've been injured, someone who says, can I help you? Is there anything I can do? Are you okay? Once they're gone from the scene, you'll never have their information again. So you want to, in that moment, ask them for their business card, ask them to put their number in your phone or to give you a call right then so that you have their number. And that's going to make it easier for your attorney down the road to get in touch with them, because once they're gone, and it's very hard to get in touch with them again. And the last thing would be, if you are asked to give a recorded statement by the insurance company, which they will try to do as soon as you get injured, if they contact you, they're going to want to get a recorded statement. But if you are considering getting an attorney, then you want to let them know that you want to hold off on that, because your attorney may not want you to give a recorded statement. So those are the five things that I would love to tell a plaintiff right when their injury happens.
I'd like to interject for just a second. It's kind of cool that we all have cameras on us now, because we all have phones that have have cameras in them. And I had a very, very slight accident where somebody instead of braking, hit the gas and we were already at a light. So it was just that she punctured my spare tire on the back of my old car. Mm-hmm. And so she had little cones on the front of her car, on the license plate on the front of her car or whatever that was. And then she had, there was a hole in the cover of my spare tire. And I just thought it was an easy case. We did not report it. Mm. Luckily, I just thought to take pictures. I just said, you know what? I've got it here. And she was really nice. She gave me all her information. It just seemed like it was just said and done. Well, her husband got into the mix and just denied everything. And I just couldn't believe it. And it wasn't that big of a case, but, it would have hurt them a lot more because of their, premiums going up and everything. And so it was great because I had the pictures. I mean, it's just
that's
said
it,
and done.
Proof.
So, yeah, just to kind of confirm what you were
saying. You'll get the saddest sob story right at the scene, and you'll get all of the information. But at the end of the day, you always want to have that third party, the police officer, there.
So it seems like what we've talked about so far has to do with just getting in an accident on your own time. What happens if you're on the job or you get injured on your job? What does Georgia require an employer to do for you?
Well, Georgia's Workers' Compensation Act has a list of things that an employer is required to do. Number one is to provide that employee with reasonable and necessary medical care. There's typically a panel of physicians that every employer has posted. And if they don't have a panel, then the employer would have to pay for any doctor that you go to. But anything that's necessary for your injury that occurred on the job. If you're out for more than 7 days, then they are required to pay you income benefits. And in Georgia, you are entitled to 66% of your average weekly wage. And if your 66% is more than 525, you can't get any more than that. The max is capped at 525 a week. But if you are working less because you have been injured, then you're entitled to temporary partial disability, which is 66% of whatever the difference is between what you were making before you were injured and what you are now making now that you are injured. You're also entitled to mileage and travel reimbursement. If you're going back and forth to your doctor, then they pay you for your travel. They pay you for your parking. And also, if your doctor says that you are permanently disabled to an extent, let's say they say you're 10% disabled in your arm because you've had a rotator cuff injury, just for example, there's an actual cost, there's an amount that the Workers' Comp Act requires that the employer pay because of that disability.
Now, does it matter what size your employer is or how many people they employ?
They have to have more than two employees to be required to have workers' compensation coverage. So as long as they have the coverage, then it doesn't matter what size. And the website for the State Board of Workers' Comp is really great, and they actually have an online verification where you can go and see what coverage your employer has, because usually that information isn't readily available.
I have a different question. How can someone have both a personal injury claim and a workers' comp claim for the same incident?
Well, this would apply to people who are injured by someone other than their employer. They're working within the course and scope of their job, but they're injured by someone else. So, for example, if someone is a driver for a company and they are hit by one of those uninsured drivers that we've been talking about, I'm just kidding, actually a driver who has insurance, they would have not only a claim with their employer's workers' compensation insurance, but they would also have a claim against the at-fault driver's insurance. So they want to get an attorney who can not only handle their workers' comp claim, they would also want an attorney who can handle their personal injury claim as well, which our firm does handle both, but if not, you can get an attorney for each separate claim.
Yeah, and it seems like there's attorneys, from what I've been experiencing, especially with the show, that some specifically work on personal injury and others specifically work on workers' comp. So it's great that your firm actually has best of both worlds.
All right. We do have quite a few cases where there are both, and there are some nuances, so it does help to have both.
Well, you have been very thorough, and we've really enjoyed you here. Can you tell our listening audience how they can get in touch with you?
I can. At Ashenden Associates, our main line is 770-394-8909. We've got representatives available for free consultation 24/7. And if you want to email me, my email address is julia@ashendenlaw.com.
Great. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And he's been so quiet and just so patient, ready to talk to us. Eric here with Winter, Capriola, and Zenner. He is rated AV by Martindale Hubbell Law Directory, which is its highest professional rating. Eric was named among the Georgia Rising Stars list by Super Lawyers as one of the top up-and-coming attorneys in Georgia for 2013 and 14. Each year, no more than 2.5% of lawyers in the state received this honor. Eric Coleman is a member of Winter Capriola Zenner's LLC's litigation team, focusing his practice on all aspects of litigation in both Georgia and federal courts, concentrating on commercial litigation, construction litigation, business torts, and other business disputes. Eric received his Juris Doctor, Eric received his Juris Doctor cum laude from the University of Georgia School of Law in 2009, where he was a Vice Justice in Phi Alpha Delta Law Fraternity. Eric received his Bachelor of Science from the University of Mississippi in 2004. And this is very interesting. From 2001 to 2007, he served in the Mississippi Army National Guard as an M1 Abrams main battle tank gunner.
That's right.
I love that. He was deployed to Iraq for all of 2005, where at the rank of sergeant, he served as a vehicle commander and dismounted team leader, utilizing the Humvee instead of a tank, and participating in over 250 combat missions. For his service in Operation Iraqi Freedom 3, Eric was twice awarded the Army Commendation Medal and the Combat Action Badge, among other individual and unit distinctions. Thank you for serving our country.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here today.
You're welcome, and I just love to hear about the tank. Tell me more. It's not on your questions.
Yeah, sure. I enlisted in the military in April of 2001. And so, of course, that was a few months before our country got involved in international conflict in a new kind of way. So when I signed up, in my mind, it was about college primarily and, the experience. And so I picked M1 tanks because I found it interesting. And we, at that time, had not been in a major conflict in a long, long time.
Right.
And so when I was thinking about tanks, I really wasn't thinking about being at war in the desert, 4 years later.
Wow.
So, but my, I trained on the tanks and I was a tanker. That was my training. But when we deployed to Iraq in 2005, the tank was kind of wasn't really fitting with the mission at that time because
it's efficient?
A little bit like a bull in a china shop with what we were trying to do in 2005. So we did have some tanks there, but they were primarily kind of in the back and they stayed out of the way. And so we were on Humvees, a lot more mobile. Mm-hmm. So we had to reorganize for that.
Wow. Wow. To be able to just, I just can't even imagine it to be able to, go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was going to say, how often do you wish you had a tank when you're dealing with some community association?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been some cases where, a good tank might have streamlined negotiations.
I have to say something. I saw the show that some guy went crazy with a tank and, like, knocked down an entire neighborhood. That was a couple of years ago.
I've seen something like that. Yeah.
That wasn't you, was it?
No.
No, I'm just kidding. But to be so versatile in everything that you do is incredible. And we will talk about the community associations and what you do. What should a newly elected board of directors of a community association do after an election?
Yeah, sure. So when I say newly elected, what I'm talking about is when you've got a new community that's been under the control of your developer and your developer's been taking care of everything. And, you know, I'm usually talking at this point about condominiums and townhome developments. But it can be relevant in single-family home communities as well, depending on the issues. And at some point, you reach the point where the homeowners are going to take over sort of the operations of the association. And when they do that, that they've got to make sure, number one, that they get the documents from the developer. And that's going to include, especially for condominium buildings, all of the architectural drawings and site plans. You've got a set of manuals, operations manuals. You should get warranties, documentation on that. And often you need the warranties to be assigned to the association from the developer, especially roof warranties. Those are often good for a decade or more, and sometimes that process is overlooked during that what's called turnover period. And as a result, you wind up with a community that has a warranty for a roof, yet they don't have the ability to really make a claim, and maybe that developer goes belly up, or they're hard to find, or they're non-community later. So that's important. So once you've taken care of getting your documentation, the second thing that a board needs to do is what's called a reserve study. And that's a study that's prepared by professionals such as engineers. And what they do is come to your building or your community and they make observations about your roof structures and all of the different components of your building. And they develop sort of a 5, 10, 20-year plan for both maintenance and anticipated repairs. Mm-hmm. Most all community association governing documents require that a board do that, because without that, it's impossible to adequately budget for your future needs. And when you're in a community, when you're in a high-rise condominium, that reserve budget over 10 years is the responsibility of those that live there, and it can be millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that that budget be established early and that it be an accurate budget that was determined not by what some layman board members might think, but rather by the input of a professional engineer.
So it's almost like having an inspector come out.
It is.
When you buy a house.
That's right. And then with the documents and the reserve study, the last thing you want to do is, find out if you've got some problems that need to be addressed with the developer. Are there leaks? Have there been water main breaks? Have there been problems that have manifested themselves before turnover? And is there anything that's discovered during the reserve study that gives you pause? And if so, it's important that those issues be identified and further investigated immediately. There's some very strict timelines and you can get into some real trouble with timing issues if those sorts of issues aren't addressed early.
And this is important too, as a homeowner, and if you're a member of a homeowners association, there's always questions when things come up, whether you're responsible or the homeowner's responsible for whatever issues has arised. What are the responsibilities and obligations of a condominium or homeowners association?
Yeah, and that's something that especially first-time condominium owners are often a little bit confused about. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when someone purchases a condominium for the first time, they may be coming from an apartment sort of situation where they were renting and they had a landlord. And so when problems came up within their unit or outside of their unit, it was expected and, of course, anticipated the landlord's going to take care of those issues. It's very different inside of a condominium. because you own that piece of property. And so when issues come up inside your unit, it's almost always your individual responsibility. And that's pretty clear to most condominium owners, but where questions arise is, what about my windows? Or what about my doors? Or what about the interior walls? What if I want to replace my floors? And all those questions can involve not only your unit, but perhaps the unit above, below, to the left or right of you, as well as the outside of the building, which may involve the association's property or what's called common elements. And there's no way to answer that question for every community because it's going to vary based on the way those governing documents are drafted. If you have a property management company, they can probably help walk you through those. And then ultimately, sometimes those issues fall into the sort of disputes where attorneys have to be involved to really parse out those lines. And it can come down to, you know, the dividing marker on a 2x4 in an interior wall. I mean, it can be pretty detailed.
Wow. Yeah, so I would definitely want to have an attorney on my side for that. Yeah. So tell me, what happens if a homeowner doesn't pay his or her assessments?
That's an issue that comes up in almost every community. And unfortunately, some owners don't view their condominium or homeowners association assessments as the same level of obligation that they might have for, say, their mortgage or their car payment or their electric bills. The reality is that Georgia law, it has some pretty favorable ways for a community association to collect those assessments.
Okay.
Not the least of which is the fact that it's automatically, under statute, a lien over the property. And so if you don't pay your homeowners association dues, that homeowners association now has a lien on your property that's created by operation of law. And that's a lot bigger obligation than most any other debt that you have.
Right. Wow.
It's the type of debt that you can wind up losing your home over by not paying your homeowners association. And that's kind of the legal side of it. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you can get stuck with paying the homeowners association's attorney's fees and late fees and interest. It can become very expensive. That's the legal side of it. On the flip side, it's your neighbors that are picking up, you know, the slack if you're not paying. And so it's important, you know, just to be a good neighbor that, you know, you pay your obligations and you do so on time.
So really, a lot of people I know take that for granted and a lot of times don't pay, you know, on time or just like I said, take it lightly and maybe pay here and there. But you're really stressing the importance of.
That's right. And if you're on a board of directors at your association and you have delinquent assessments, then the main thing that you should
doesn't say very good.
Well, the main thing that you should know is that you've got a short time frame to get those collected. Your governing documents probably allow you to recover some of the attorney's fees and you have some lien rights. And so, you know, it's time to take action on that and get those dues collected. It's the right thing to do for your community. It's the right thing to do for your other neighbors. And that's something that our firm does, you know, hundreds and thousands of those types of actions every year.
That sounds good. Alex?
Sure. So we talked just a little bit about what's an owner's responsibility and what might be the responsibility of the association. How do construction defects fall into that?
Well, the construction defects are the kind of thing, like I said, that you want to identify early. And more often than not, it begins with a leak.
Okay.
But in a large multi-story condominium building, water coming in through the walls isn't as simple as it might be in your single-family home where maybe you've got a shingle pulled up. There's tons of complex building elements that go into the construction of these commercial-style buildings. And so when you've got water coming in, it's very important that you figure out why and how that's happening so that you can take proper action against the responsible parties, because obviously the building shouldn't leak, before it's too late. And it can be too late very quickly when a board of directors gets control from their developer.
Let me ask you, too. It seems like construction defect is a term that can be kind of thrown around. What's the legal definition?
Well, the legal definition of construction defect is really just, is there a problem with the community? Was the building built in such a way that it's contrary to industry standards and norms? And that's kind of the legalese way of saying, would other construction experts in this field agree that this isn't the right way to have done this? And sometimes it can be as simple as installing a flashing upside down so that it brings water in instead of getting it out. But there can be much more complex issues from there, and it often involves a waterproofing expert, a building or structural engineer, and a team of attorneys to really address those issues effectively.
So I'm sure in those situations, having the community be well managed can be very helpful. In your experience, do you think that self-managed communities are the way to go, or do you prefer to see management companies?
Yeah, self-managed communities, with rare exception, are going to be very challenging for that community. Often, I was on the board of directors of my own community for a while, and I can, even with my experience in this field, found it very challenging to work with that community to get done what needed to be done. And we were self-managed at the time, and we aren't anymore. And it's because it's a full-time job, it really is, to make sure all the contracts are paid, that things are properly negotiated, that the budgets are done, and there's just a lot of stuff that goes on. And to do that effectively, a community really needs someone that's dedicated and has experience in that field. And when a group of volunteers, which is what all community association boards are, try to do that in their spare time, they'll find themselves both frustrated and without sufficient resources to really get the job done. And the larger your community is, the less efficient that is.
Now, I'm sure it's a lot easier in the sense when you have a managed community, you don't have to worry about fraud in the same way that you do when you've got a self-managed community. Are there some indicators that people who do live in community associations can look for if they suspect fraud?
That's right. I mean, like you said, the first step is to avoid self-management. But if a community is self-managed, it's important that there not be one person who's in charge of the finances to the exclusion of everyone else. And the times that we've seen fraud rear up in some communities is when you've got one or possibly two people who have total control of the association's bank accounts, budgets, and bank statements, and the other board members and the rest of the community is not looking over their shoulders, so to speak. And while you don't want to proactively accuse your neighbors of fraud, in any situation where there's large amounts of money flowing through a group of people, it's beneficial to have a number of people who monitor what goes in and what comes out, just to avoid any sort of appearance even of problems.
Now, you probably work with other professions, because you said you would need to have different professions on, like if there's a water leak. Can you tell me some people that you regularly work with?
Yeah, I mean, one of an engineering firm that we work with on a regular basis is Ray Engineering. His office is out of Norcross, but he covers the entire metro area, and he's been Steve Ray, the principal there, has been great to work with, he's done a lot of good work for our communities that we've partnered with him on. When it comes to waterproofing issues, we often will look to a firm called BETEC, that's BETEC, they've done a lot of great work for us as well, and they've put together some really great reports that have all the pictures and documentation necessary to help us do our job as the attorneys.
That's great. So you work as a team with these other companies.
That's right. I mean, a lot of these construction cases can be $1 million and more easily. And we put together a team of industry experts and lawyers that work together with the board and the property management to kind of navigate the case through all of those complexities.
Are there other types of attorneys that refer you business on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, attorneys that work in the real estate field.
Like Alex?
we do need to talk after this. I do think I have a case for you.
That happens every time.
attorneys, any kind of attorney that touches on real estate is going to come up on some issues that involve construction defect type work. And there are a lot of specialized statutes, particularly in residential construction, that apply to the process of bringing a claim. And so if you don't have experience in that particular realm and you start down that path, you can quickly go off course.
Sure.
There's a lot of very specific timings that have to be met and notices that have to be given to the proper people and inspection procedures and all of these things. It's all statutory. And so what we'll often find is that an attorney who's practicing in the world of real estate or even representing homeowners associations that might be our competitors when it comes to the general representation of homeowners, well, if they come across a construction defect type case, we'll sometimes refer that to us so that we can handle that specialized process.
That's fantastic.
Well, I will very happily stay in my lane. I know what I don't know. So that's awesome. I'm glad to have you as a resource.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And let's tell our listeners, Eric, how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. You can call me at 404-844-5663. And you can visit our website at wczlaw.net. That's WCZ as in zebra, law.net.
Awesome. And Alex, I forgot to say, how can everybody get in touch with you?
Oh, sure. I'm really easy to find here on the radio. And you can
all
also
over social media, too.
And all over social media. And the quickest one-stop way to find me is at our company website, and that's www.bagwellassociates.com.
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I think you need your own show.
I'm happy to co-host yours. This has been a great time.
Good, good. And I just want to thank my guests again. It's such a wealth of knowledge. And all I know is every week I just say to myself, when can I get an attorney? Like almost every situation, I think it's just so great to call an attorney first in anything. And especially when they offer free consultation, just to make sure that you're covering your...
Yeah, that seems to be kind of a common thread on a lot of the shows, as they say, Julia was talking about with insurance companies, is you know, they're not necessarily going to be your best friend. You know, they're looking for their bottom line. And so they say to check with your attorney first before you start, because I don't know if you didn't say it, but another attorney said, when you're calling, they'll record that, and then that can be used against you, you know, and you think, but I did have a quick question for you on the, or an observation. I thought this idea of checking with the witnesses right nearby and getting their information, because they'll come up to you and they want to be that good Samaritan and help out. What can I do for you? Right. Well, you can do this. Can I get your information? So if there's something that rises, you know, because otherwise, yeah, you're never going to find these people again. Yeah. Unless it's on TV, somehow they find these people. Whatever, yeah, right. But that was a great point.
It is very rare, and you know, people want to help. You know, people want to be able to say exactly what they saw. But once they're gone, a lot of times the supervisor or the employee could say something different for something that happened, especially in a premises case. When there's a motor vehicle accident, you know there was an accident. Right. But if it's water on the floor, you know, you could have an employee say, well, no, I cleaned it up, and your witness is the only one to say, no, I know there was water there.
Now, do you find that people are more willing to speak to the actual victim than police? Because I know if I was a victim, I would think, well, you know, the police are going to take care of it. But then you think too that people might be,
I don't want to get involved kind of thing, right?
People might be fearful. Like, well, I don't want to be in court.
Right.
And so do you recommend, you know, that the victim in those cases deal with it themselves or expect the police will do it?
That's a very good point. You don't want to rely on the police. I mean, I know they are there to protect and serve you, but they are focused on the big picture accident. And a lot of times all of the people who are around, they may not get the information. Sometimes people will talk to police, but they just don't take that information down. If they don't think it's relevant at the time, if they think it's cut and dry, they just may not put it on the report. And if it's not on the report, then it won't be there for your attorney to track them down later. So I do think it should be in the hands of the victim to make sure they get all the information they can for themselves.
Now, do you ever run into issues where, say, the police report won't mention that witnesses were present, but they were and contact information was gathered? How do you deal with that?
It happens more often than you would think.
Wow.
And we have a couple of ways. One way is to contact the officer directly. And if we can do that soon enough, he or she can either recall who they talked to, or they can look in their notes, maybe something handwritten that was not put in the actual police report. But we also check the 911 records, because people will see what happened and they'll call 911 and their number will be recorded along with their name. But the police officer either won't record their information or they're gone by the time the police get there. That happens a lot in motor vehicle accidents. You'll basically pass the incident and call because you feel bad, but you don't have time to stop.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So the onus is really on you as a victim, yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, and I always make sure when I witness an accident that I talk to the cops. And so that's a great point, because sometimes they're not going to be there for the victim. So I don't know if I know who's at fault. Like, I don't want some stranger coming up to me, you know, but I would love to go over to them. I would try to make a point now to go over to them and give them my information.
Right, that really is a helpful way.
Plus, I mean, as police officers, they're overwhelmed. They've got a lot on their plate, and that's not the only incident they're dealing with.
Exactly.
Whatever. Yeah. I do have a quick question for Julia. What's your next appearance? Or, pardon me?
Dahlia.
Oh, sorry, Dahlia.
Oh, Dahlia.
I'm sorry. Julia Dahlia.
It's just radio, whatever. Yeah, so we'll edit that later. But yeah, so I'm sorry, Dahlia. When is your next event, or what's your next speaking engagement or community? You have a town hall meeting, or how do you get the word out? You're a campaign, I guess, around.
Yeah, we have a lot going on. We are definitely trying to make that direct voter contact, door to door, knocking on doors, phone banking. A lot of small community meet and greets, just individuals who are trying to spread the word. And so we have a lot of things going on. We actually more recently just had a Tea Party forum where all the candidates were invited. So I recently spoke at that. And then coming up, we have a forum where it will just be the DA candidates, and that's hosted by the Junior League of Douglas County. And I believe that that's the 21st of October that will be taking place. Really close to the voting day.
Was that a tea party, like the Tea Party political party, or just serving tea?
The political party, although I did tell my children that it was the Tea Party, and they asked what kind of tea they had.
Right,
so.
Exactly. And, yeah, I was just wondering, like, any door knocking? Do you guys still knock on doors?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's a very effective way to get the word out, and so we've definitely been doing that, and we'll continue to do that all the way up until November 4th.
That's smart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll be happy to have everybody back for another show. This is Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices, and again, you can see all of the shows that we've had on at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. This is AL Radio, and Emily Rowell, your host, with Alex Brown, your co-host.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Signing out.